Hey, y'all. It's Monica. I recently got back together with our old friend Clint Powell. We normally talk about everything from work to life to personal to politics. This time we got a little personal, and I shared with him some of my reflections on my recent life experiences. So I hope that you like this little change of pace. This is a somewhat abridged version, so if you want to hear the whole thing or listen to any of Clint's other great interviews, shows, go to During the Break on your favorite podcasting platform. This was posted on February 22nd, so just scroll back and you can find it there. I'll also put the link in the show notes. Enjoy.
So Monica Perez has been on with me a number of times. I think the best way I can explain it, she's some sort of quasi-libertarian, conservative, liberal. I don't know. She's a radio badass. She's a podcast badass. And this logo right here, ladies and gentlemen, that's her O logo. We're not doing that anymore. We don't deal in old stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, we deal in new stuff. Look at this. The Monica Perez Show is back, baby. She's been out for 3 or 4 weeks. She's going to tell us why. Let's pull this one off the screen. Welcome her up. And again, if there's technical issues, everybody be patient. We can't control the galaxy or whatever's happening in Davos or Debos or wherever that. What's up, Monica Perez?
Hey, I would say I'll accept all of it, but you'd have to say classical liberal, not liberal.
Is that what you are?
Liberals hijacked classical liberal.
Oh, I didn't.
They hijacked that the constitutional, like the ideological foundation of our, at least the Articles of Confederation, I would say. I'm an Articles of Confederationist. Let's just call me that.
So I'm assuming that means woke. The woke has hijacked the left. Maybe MAGA's hijacked a little bit of the right. Everybody's
awake,
had something hijacked.
Not woke. Yep.
Woke, wake,
control
whatever.
Language controls the thoughts.
All right. Well, we got a lot of stuff to cover. So before we go down this road, I want to touch on, well, let's just touch on the main thing. You've been out for 3 or 4 weeks.
Yes. And I was going slow before that because my mom, who was a big fan of you, really was in decline. She was 95. She made it till her 95th birthday, but she died a week later. And it was a strain, like it's been a few weeks, so I'm totally fine, but I definitely had to like completely get off the grid. But those last weeks and months were intense. And, you know, she had 9 kids while she was down to 7, but everybody came and helped her and took care of her. She was absolutely adamant about not doing hospice. And it was quite an education. Like it was such a, like an interesting, she was really a genius because she said like, I'll make saints out of you kids. And like really caring for somebody, you know, it's easy to care for a little baby or, you know, maybe not easy, but it's manageable to take care of somebody on the other end of the lifespan is something I think that hospice has insulated people from. And it was, she was right. Like it was basically a spiritual experience.
My grandfather, who
anyway,
was very,
but she,
my,
you know, yeah.
I was just gonna say my grandfather, who was very, he was one of the biggest characters in my childhood. When I was in my early 20s, he got cancer and then got very sick after that. And we took care of him, my mom, my dad, the family, his wife, that we took turns. We were all there. I was holding his hand when he passed. And so to your point, hospice actually was only coming in to relieve us in the evenings. And we had just left his house and they called and said, hey, come on back. But just to affirm what you're saying, it was a very, I wouldn't trade that moment. It's a horrible moment, but I wouldn't have traded that time of being there for him. So, yeah, but it wasn't my mom, which is much.
It really taught me something because, well, but also I have my son who's 18. He's like really got words of wisdom. I don't know. It's like he's an old soul or something. But a while ago, he's like, how are you handling, you know, your mom, like kind of going downhill, let's say. And I was like, whatever, I'm just ignoring it and I'll just deal with it later. He's like, no, you can't do that. Like it's a real privilege to be able to prepare for someone's death. And like, you should not squander that. And so I didn't, and I was totally, I really, you know, tried to get my mind around it, even though I just wanted to watch Turner Classic Movies and drink Irish whiskey with her until, like, you know, the last day. I just had to get my mind around what was happening. And then towards the end, when she really couldn't, you know, she just needed physical help constantly. Like, that's not my super expertise. Like, I do have a son who has Down syndrome. He does need some of that. But I just walked in and we had to take turns individually. Like, there weren't enough people to have, like, teams constantly. And at first I was, like, intimidated and overwhelmed. And I was like, you know what? She's fine with me being an amateur. I'm just going to, like, get my mind around this and I'm going to do it. And it taught me what was doable. Like, some people were like, hey, we should probably call hospice now. And she was adamantly opposed to that. So you can, you know, if you get over that intimidation, you may be able to push that off. I'm not suggesting any decisions for other people in those moments, but it was, you know, very empowering. And it also really, like, my priest said, like, it's, people have been helping each other die, you know, since the beginning of time. Like, you really don't need a bunch of professionals around you. You can do it. And we did. And it just, like, the love that you have to share with somebody to not only be the person who's helping, but to accept humbly that help is, you know, that's the thing. It's that humble acceptance of being, like, totally helpless at somebody else's mercy and having the faith in them that they love you. And it's not a burden. It's a sharing. And it was really intense. And it was like a gift. So there you go.
Yeah. My grandfather, he had cancer, and then he had a stroke while he was recovering from cancer. And then he fell out of his bed and broke his arm. So he couldn't move his left arm from a stroke, and he couldn't move his right arm from being broke.
Oh my gosh.
So we were, the last 2 weeks we were bathing him, and he was a very big,
very hard to take strong care of.
Guy. Yeah. But I just remember
can't help at all.
Right. And I just remember, the last thing my mom said to him, my mom and my grandmother and my dad were on one side of the bed, and I was over on this side of the bed, and we were holding his hand, and his eyes were darting back and forth to us. I don't think I've ever told this story. So and all of a sudden my mom goes, "Dad, it's going to be okay. You've raised us right. We're going to be fine. You are loved. Good job." And he died within 10 seconds. He was,
I definitely knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot that we had the opportunity to communicate with each other. You know, she could communicate clear as a bell until, like, maybe 36 hours before she died. And then,
I have a question for you. Because you told me a little something before we came live, and I apologize, there's a delay. But you said that she did not like people to cry at funerals at all. Did she make it mandatory there would be no tears?
Yeah.
Just drinking or something? How did she?
I asked her. So, and my producer, Bobby, like, laughs. He's always like, stay Irish, which of course to us means, like, you don't cry, awake as a party, blah, blah, blah. So before she kind of lost it, which was the last 36 hours, she knew, and she was laying back. She's like, "Oh, it's so peaceful. I can't believe it. Like, I didn't know dying would be like this. I'm so at peace," whatever. And then my niece and my nephew and his wife came over, and they were, like, crying. And I said, so that my niece-in-law is a hairdresser. So she, like, started fixing her hair. And I was like, "Oh yeah, let her fix your hair, Mom." And she said, "No, open casket." And I said, no, let her fix it for Dad. And she's like, okay. So, and then my niece was crying. And I said, "You can't cry. She won't even let us cry at the funeral." She said, and my mom said, "No, it's okay. You can cry a little." I said, okay. So
you can still,
I mean,
do
that's
the
how
impression.
Open, like, that's what I'm telling.
You can still do the
impression.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, that's right. Oh, I was so worried I was going to lose it. But I really feel like I can only do it if she actually said the thing. So yeah. I'll see if I'll probably never be able to ad lib. But the idea that she had dedicated her entire life to serve, like, you know, as I said to Jesus when she was a little messed up at the end, and I was like, "Man, you got to take her. Like, I'm not, like, she's your faithful servant, and she does not want the hospice, and we, you know, this is not, it's not gonna be cool." And he did. But
yeah.
But she was a faithful servant. And, you know, it's weird because I do struggle with my own faith, but like there was nothing but a sense of, you know, accomplishment and joy. Like there was no, when she died, there was no doubt in my mind that she went to heaven. Yeah. Like, I don't even know that there's a heaven, but like that was very clear. And several people have told me, three different people, really, maybe more poignant things about like her communicating with them or being present. So the day she died, which was a Thursday, my brother and I were there. And he asked me to get down on my knees and pray. And this is George, the friendly truck driver. He's like a hard guy, not a soft guy. And we were on our knees praying. And he was just like, Ma, give us a sign that you're already there, that you're already past the pearly gates. Give us a sign. And I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't care, Mom, about signs, but I'll ask you for it. He wants the sign. And on Saturday, 2 days later, so her birthday was on a Thursday. She died exactly 1 week after her birthday. And then we asked on that day. 2 days later, I got an email from Stuart, a listener. And he said, I work at a farm on Thursdays. I was at the farm on Thursday. And when I got in the car, I felt your mother's presence. And I felt like I had to say a prayer. And he said, and I'm like that. I have these feelings, but a lot of times something bad is going down. But I remembered that you said in a recent show that her birthday was on Thursday. So I was hoping it's just her birthday, except for I think I'm a week late. So the day she died, probably at the moment I was on my knees with my brother asking for a sign, Stuart got this from her. And what Stuart did, so then he reached out to me. I hadn't told anybody that she died. So nobody, like no social media, nobody knew, none of my listeners knew. And he reached out to me, so I told him, and then he was in the Discord group, so he communicated with all these people who love her and who she loved, who she, you know, didn't know, but this transcendental thing, and they started praying and reaching out to me, and like, so there was a reason, you know, there was a purpose to that. It's very woo-woo to me. It's very hard for me to get my mind around that, but just, you know, I told her, I always say, like, if you want to give me a sign, I said this to my dad too, I will recognize it and accept it. I will not be skeptical about it, you know? And it could not have been like more clear at that moment, had a purpose. It was her. I mean, how do you reject that kind of, I don't think you can.
Yeah. What a great thing to be said about you though. What a faithful servant. My mom is like that. My mom is the prayer warrior. And I'll wrap this part of it up and then we're going to move into some new stuff you have coming up. But absolutely, I'll say this, I had a kind of an experience with my grandfather. He had passed and I couldn't, you cry a little bit, but I was in my early 20s and I was just at his house so much growing up. I mean, he was my default. I was his runaround buddy, even till I was 20. I mean, I was everywhere with him. Right. And I remember I was kind of pissed and because I was 22 or 23, getting ready to graduate and all that. And I was struggling with it. Just personally struggling. And I kind of said the same thing. I'm like, Papa, I need something. And I had a dream one night. And I kid you not, I was back in his room. He had antiques. He was an antique dealer. He had this old antique bed and I was sitting on the edge of the bed. Oh, cool. I could smell. I mean, have you ever had those dreams where they're just tangible? You can feel it. I could smell his cologne. Yeah. He walked in chewing a cigar in his old favorite jacket from his engineer on the railroad days. And he sat down next to me and sat down next to me. He put his hand on me. I said, Bubba, because that's what he called me. He said, Bubba, I'm good. You need to live. Got it marked out. That's a real deal.
That's all you need.
It's a real deal.
And that's how I feel. Like, I know my mother is super positive. One thing that really like puts more wind under my sails is that she, because I think about podcasts, you know, I have a lot of degrees. I went to school until I was 30. My husband works hard. He pays for everything. And I spend a lot of time and effort like on podcasting. And, you know, is it question like, is this a great use of time? And she really loved it. And she thought it was valuable. And she and my brother, who was there with me at the end with her, we were all practicing Catholics and we have kind of the same value system. And they both like felt strongly that this communication, these connections, this sharing of information and values and keeping our culture strong and making sure that you know, we vet issues, make sure we all, you know, understand the difference between right and wrong and are working towards the right thing and give each other strength. Like she just thought it was great. Like she one of the last things she said was like, "You do such good work." And I'm like, "What?" So I feel like excited to continue. And I just, you know, try to be as Irish as possible, get right back on your feet, you know, keep working. And so I'm like, yeah, I'm excited to try another, you know, go to the next phase of this journey.
Well, we're going to talk about that. And I'll say this, one of the things that I think she was probably recognizing that we all do is that I think we're kind of spoiled in America. We just assume that freedom and the ability to do this is just, that's the way it is. And what we don't understand, and you've had Eric Buchanan on quite a bit, this is an anomaly basically throughout history. A lot of times this, what we've built in America, whether it's not great, you know, it's not exactly what it was supposed to be. I understand there's a lot of flaws, but we have created a place to where you're supposed to be able to stand up and go, "I disagree. Let's talk that through before we start implementing it. And I want a way out if I don't want to do it." That's the culture that allowed her to be a faithful servant. She would have been a faithful servant anyway, but I think she kind of saw that we live in a special place and it requires the conversations that aren't around just spiritual things to create the atmosphere.
Oh, yes.
Right. You know,
they were
the plants of freedom have to grow from a soil. Yeah.
Yeah. They were,
your mom was a political,
political. Yeah. They used to work for William F. Buckley when the National Review first started. And then years later, they started to smell a rat with William F. Buckley, who, of course, was a CIA agent. So I think that was good on them, because he fired Joe Sobran like in a fax, and Joe Sobran was rock solid. So they knew there was something wrong with William F. Buckley. But yeah, they were always, even with nine kids, they were politically
Monica,
active.
Listen, real quick, I am so disappointed in you. We're going to talk about new stuff, but you just said facts, and now I have to explain to everybody under 30 what
a facsimile is.
Kids,
yes,
we didn't
it's
used
like
to
an
have
email.
Emails.
It's like a physical email.
Except hey, you ready for this?
Sure.
What's up with Ecuador and the Chinese immigrant? Which one do you want to talk about
first? It's the same. So...
talk about a good segue.
I know that was very, very context and continuity, as they say in radio. So what happened was I was listening. So I'm plugging back into the news after being completely out of it for at least a month. And they're like, there's jillions of Chinese illegal immigrants in San Diego who like walked across the border. I'm like, okay. And it's up like 20 times from this time last year. Like, okay, that's a psyop. I mean, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying somebody did that on purpose. And I haven't cracked the code on what the agenda is for this particular immigration crisis, but I wanted to understand the origins. Go ahead. What do you got?
No, I'm listening. Okay. This is my intrigued look.
So I was, So I was looking into it and I thought like it has to come from somewhere. So I found this super big, long article on CNN, which is like giving you all the like emotional stuff and all the pictures and everything. And I was like, at some point in this like 20 page article, they're going to tell me where these people are coming from. So it ends up that this might not be the whole story, but what I found there, where I landed in that article, was that Ecuador does not require, I guess, visas for Chinese people, and they have a little cottage industry, is what they actually called it, to set Chinese people who fly there from China onto what they call the walking route to the United States from Ecuador, which is far. So I'm sure it's not all walking. Mm-hmm. But they're doing that. And I mean, reading this article, I'm thinking this is obviously a policy decision. And I know the policy is coming from the US, you know, covert or overt, it's coming from the US. So whoever's running Ecuador is definitely in our pocket. Like for sure. I'll look into that, you know, when I get a chance, but now I got my, you know, now I know where they're coming from. Next day, there's an article, which was yesterday, in the Wall Street Journal about Ecuador and what I'm calling the military or the Defense Department's cash for clunkers. So they said to Ecuador, "Give us all your old, rusty Russian Soviet weaponry from 40 years ago, because Ukrainians know how to use that." So Ukrainians, this is their official story. It's preposterous. Ukrainians fighting in Ukraine right now are used to Soviet weaponry. Okay, so the Iron Curtain fell like in 1990. Is that correct? So they're saying that these soldiers right now are drawing on experience from 40 years ago. So they're all in their 60s. It's preposterous. And Ecuador said it's scrap anyway. You can have it. And then our government is saying, all right, we're going to trade you like modern weaponry to use on your own people because you have a drug cartel problem. So a lot of flags went off there. The whole cash for clunkers thing is ridiculous. And the Soviets said, we just basically give you that stuff, but it says very clearly in our contract that you're not allowed to transfer it to anybody else. So you're not allowed to do it anyway. And I think Ecuador did decide to not do it because Russia said they found pests in their bananas and they stopped importing their bananas. And Ecuador stood down and Russia's importing their bananas. So anyway, but I was like, okay. Yes. I don't even know. Like, I don't know the truth about the bananas. You know, that was the Wall Street Journal story. But I was like, okay, now I got to figure out who is this guy, Noboa, who's running Ecuador. Ecuador should not be in the newspaper twice in 2 days. So I was like, I remember from yesterday, I decided the Ecuadorian guy has to be an American puppet. Let's see. Let's just wiki him. Literally, first sentence, he's born in Miami. So obviously he's American. He went to, where'd he go? He went to Harvard for something. He went to Northwestern for something. He went to George Washington University for something. And his big degree, NYU. He's the youngest president Ecuador has ever had. He's one of the youngest presidents in the world. And I didn't look if he was a young global leader for the World Economic Forum. I would bet good money that he was, whatever. And then, but his dad's like a banana billionaire. So I guess when push came to shove, threatening the banana wealth made him take dad's side instead of the US. But I realized that this guy's a major puppet. They were in the news for some like drug cartel thing taking over a TV station. But my opinion is that this guy is just looking to arm up because I believe he took power in what I know people are calling it a coup. His predecessor was impeached. He won in a snap election that he was polling at 3% and ended up winning. there was a runoff. Like, it's so preposterous. He's got to run again.
And I'm reading up on it right now.
Yeah. He's got to run again in 18 months. And he was like, we need to build state-of-the-art mega prisons, which of course I'm sure our contractors will benefit from. Then a month later, there's a prison break of a drug guy on the same day that there's this big TV station thing where it was all televised, like the terrorism was televised. Like, the whole thing is absolutely preposterous. But I'm a little worried because when we send people weapons to use against their own population, no matter what the excuse, like I think he's already toyed with martial law a little bit. I feel like I would keep my eye on Ecuador in the 2025 election and see if it gets delayed, if it gets ugly. But I feel like that's our, you know, I think Biden was overseeing the emergence of like a divided world, but a reassertion of the U.S. as a like a very powerful, like hegemon, regional hegemon, like the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere, because I think they realized at a certain point, you know, they tried to have the U.S. be a unilateral, like the one superpower. And I mean, there's long been a statesman's rule of thumb that like you can't have a world hegemon, only a regional hegemon. Like, no empire can really take the entire world. And I think we've proved that again. And I think that's when they decided, okay, we need a new Iron Curtain. If we can't control the whole world, at least we're going to control our sphere and not allow like Russia and China to compete on the really important stuff.
But real quick, I'm trying to connect the two, and you've done a decent job of it. I missed something. So I believe it's an intentional thing for our border to be wide open. I believe it's degrading. I mean, it's tearing down the sovereignty. I think there's going to be, you know, now they're saying a way to path citizenship. Is they're suggesting let everybody who's an illegal immigrant serve in the military for 2 years. That's a horrible idea. I there's all of these ways they're just trying to bring him in, bring him in. You know, we see the being distracted with the headlines of sanctuary cities now that they're crying foul now that they're having to deal with the problem they said that they thought they would never have to deal with, in my opinion. But my question to you is, when you say SOP, why do you think so many fighting aged men from the Middle East, from China, from countries that we've never seen before, there's no kids. There's a big picture of them. There's a bunch of them. They're a bunch of pictures with men standing in parade rest. My question to you is, it seems like it's an intentional invasion.
Now, oh, I think we're recruiting them. So what's really stuck with my mind was I knew a cop in Brockton, Massachusetts, and I have a friend from Cape Verde. People call it Cape Verde, I bet. He calls it Cape Verde Island, which is, I think, off of Northern Africa. And he used to be my boxing coach in Atlanta, and we were still friends. And both of them said the same thing. There's this huge amount of immigration from Cape Verde to Brockton. And there are, I think that's where they were saying there was like billboards and stuff like move to Brockton, Massachusetts. That's why there's like specific from one area to another area. It's called the human rights industry. It's like an outsourced thing. It's like the equivalent of mercenaries, which you would think has more oversight, more transparency, but it actually has a lot less. So they, for every immigrant they bring over, they give them $15,000. They set them up and they get a VIG. So I think they're also given marching orders of who they, what kind of, what's the demographic of the person they want to bring over, where are they from, and where are they going to? And I would say this is such a deeply pathological operation that it's coming from the U.S. or the Western power elite, and it's designed for a couple of things. And I mean, I could just throw out there one possible reason for it is if they want to put those people in the military, you're certainly like the Oath Keepers are totally infiltrated. And if they weren't a PSYOP from the beginning, but the idea being that there are plenty of people, cops and firemen and people in the service who would not disobey the Constitution, would not fire on their own people. But if you have
mercenaries,
who don't even understand the Constitution and don't even speak the language, you know, like at Occupy Wall Street, there were people holding up English signs who didn't speak English. It's like, you don't even know what you're doing. You don't even know what you're doing. You're being recruited. And then at the same time, if you justify building a wall, walls keep you in. So if you what you want to do is shut down this country and impose martial law, I'm not saying that's the plan, but I certainly would say that's a consideration of something they would want, they being the power elite, want to plan for and have at least in place. If it came to that, do we have the wall? Do we have FEMA camps? Do we have, an army that will be stay on our side?
At least part of them. And then you combine that with the World Economic Forum that is basically saying something's going to happen. It could be a cyber event, or it could be another virus.
Well, a cyber attack will turn physical.
What I'm saying. Well, I think even a virus, the way they have destroyed the trust from the health industry and from the media world, I think anything that they come in and try, they have. And what? Let me slow down a little bit, because I want to say this. The thing that is starting to stick out to me isn't so much that they have destroyed their trust, because they have. We've watched them in real time. You can't go out, but I can. You have to wear a mask, but I don't. You have to get the vaccine. It's not been tried yet. You're the guinea pigs. And then when you ask questions, you're not given dialogue or civil discourse back and forth. You're told that you are bad and you want your neighbor to die and you can't go to your group. So they've done a job of just of building distrust. But here's what's sticking out to me. I've not seen a health organization. I have not seen a media organization come out and try to repair that trust. I've not seen anybody stand up and go, you know what? It looks like we have more mistrust now than ever. And they sit around and talk about it, but I don't see anybody standing up and go, well, here's why, guys.
Well, they might want a civil war.
The thing that bothers me about that is everything now gets physical. We have taught generations that if you disagree with something, I can bully you in the street. I can smack you. I can get mad. I can burn a house down. I can get in your face. Our politicians – you know, in the summer riots, we saw Democrat party politicians say, get in people's faces. Yeah. Do not let them have peace. We've seen Trump say some stupid rhetoric. Yeah. And so my point on all that is we've trained the last 10 to 15 years, especially the last five, we've trained people that when you disagree with something, if your cause is the government's cause, it's okay to be violent.
Yeah.
And if you respond with violence, you're the one that gets held accountable. That poor guy in the subway in New York where the guy was intimidating people and attacking him, and he put him in a chokehold, the Marine, and the guy passed away, he gets in trouble. So don't even stand up to the people who are causing. And I know I went down a rabbit hole, but my problem with all this is that I think it's an intentional plan. And when people like you start noticing it and tying these things to other countries and other leaders, that makes me even more concerned.
Yeah. I mean, this guy's an American puppet. So if you're wondering where it's coming from, I mean, he's a U.S. puppet. So if the U.S. did not want that walking route for Chinese immigrants from Ecuador to San Diego, they would stop it. They would just tell that guy to stop it.
See, the thing though that even now I'm sitting here talking to you, the fact that it's Chinese and there's Middle Eastern people in there. And again, I don't care what color people are. I just want you to if you're coming to the country, learn to love America.
It's a style. I mean, there's a reason for it. They're not doing this stuff for no reason. There's a reason for it. And I mean, it could just be like the narrative, like, oh, it's a Chinese invasion, or it could be because when you have a different religious tradition, like for thousands of years, like your culture and value system are really different. So mm-hmm. if you had just South American immigrants, you would have the Catholic thing, which we are used to. But when you have Muslim or like a Buddhist or whatever, like that's something where you don't necessarily, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, don't kill and don't steal are basics. That's true. But we're talking about like robust, rich culture. And, you know, multiculturalism isn't a thing.
But also we've seen this happen. We've seen this happen in our country the last 5 years, Monica, where politics is now quasi-religion anyway.
And it's so form over function, because nobody really stops the bombs. And that's all that matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little scary when you start thinking about it. And here's what's killing me about it. They're having debates about the border when President Trump, President Biden, any president, they have the power to shut it down if they want to. He signed all the executive orders when he came in to open it. So he's got power of the pen. They could just say, shut the border. Instead, they're suing the very state that it's affecting them the most. And I'm like, oh, do they think we're this stupid? We're not watching all of this. Everybody's helpless.
To portray it as like an actual problem that it's hard to solve is ridiculous. I mean, you just need policies and policy enforcement. We're completely capable of doing
and we
that.
Have that right now. So we're just not policies, doing it.
Policy enforcement, that's all it is. And all of this chaos and conflict is intentional, in my opinion. And you know, it's not just about letting people in to clean our houses. I mean, that's not what's going on here. No. And it all, you know, it all really stems. It wouldn't even be possible. It wouldn't even be an issue. And as a libertarian, I wouldn't even care about it, except for first, they had to put into place that property rights are not absolute, that you're not allowed to restrict entrance to your exclusive property for cultural reasons. And I'm not saying I care, you know, I have strong feelings about that. But if you're worried about drug cartels and you want to say, you know what, I don't want any immigrants in my gated community at all. I don't want to have to screen between who is in a drug cartel and who isn't. I just want nobody not born. You know, that's seems like an unpleasant approach. But if you could do that, you wouldn't have to care about them doing it at the border. But because you're not allowed to do that, you've made your own private property borders porous. And I think people don't think about that.
No, I agree. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. Yeah. If the property line and the property rights of our very country are not sacred, then the property that your house sits on is not sacred.
I'm actually saying it's reversed, is that I don't care about the US-Mexico border at all. If I have an absolute property right to defend my borders and to connect with other people, contiguous, whatever, if I could get an HOA,
I hear your
objection, yeah. But I'm just saying from a purely theoretical point of view, if I could carve out my school district, make it private, make every single solitary person say like, this is our community, we're gating it off. Nobody's allowed to live here unless they're all, you know, of the exact same value system, whatever, then, you know, you could keep going and say like, that's, you know, an anarcho-capitalist paradise, or it would, you know, would it really expand? Would that really work? I think there's a book called The Iron Web by Larkin Rose, which is kind of interesting in that way. But I'm just saying that.
You know what you just created, don't you?
Yeah. What?
Game of Thrones.
Oh, really? I couldn't watch it because like there was rape in the first episode.
But that's my
point.
You have your castle and people over there. I have mine over here. There's no sovereignty except the fact if I can take your shit, I can take your stuff. That's just that way. If you can't defend it, you can't defend it.
Well, I'm saying we are not permitted defend it. And
but
I'm
in
not
a perfect
saying
world,
that,
in a perfect yeah. world, what you just if your perfect world comes to have, you better make sure you've got some pretty good big boys on the wall.
Yeah, you have to. And if you want, you don't have to be an anarchist for it. You can say, yes, there is you can have government, and the government's job is to protect private property and, you know, which includes bodies, people. And humans, then you can say, you know, I had this HOA and we have this rule that none of those people are allowed in, and some of them are coming in. I want you to get them out of here for trespass. Like, you can still have the rule of law. I'm not suggesting.
I get it.
Property is the foundation for having violated that is why people care so much about who's where, and like having a lot of public property, like look at what happened in Portland and stuff, a lot of public property where there is nobody to defend it. Nobody will defend it. And that's
right.
Cool
and the
either.
People that were told to defend it were told to pull back, or they're told they need to be defunded. You don't go defend. I just still think that to your point, and me and you are on the exact same page. If we don't have borders, we don't have a country, and I'm okay. In my opinion, I'm okay with him with migration. I think we should 100% take people in, but it should be a process, just like would at your house if you were having a party.
I'm not even suggesting that any position on immigration, but a border is where the laws change. So I was in Switzerland. It was 6 years ago with some friends who they like to drive. So they had cars and we were driving. It was my husband's 50th birthday, and we just drove a lot, and we were all over Switzerland, which is just, you know, it looks like a postcard. And I was laughing. I was like, you pay your farmers to grow flowers, but when the grid goes down, what are you going to do with all that garbage? You need cows, more cows. And they still write to me, it's like, oh, we laugh at our friend, you know, with our friends about our stupid American who thinks that our flowers are garbage. And I'm like, you're missing my metaphysical point. But anyway, so I remember, we're in the mountains and we cross over to Italy, and it was like the line was actually, you know, geological. Like, we crossed over and it went from Switzerland to just a very dirty, messy, cacophonous, you know, pickpockety, like a lot of immigrants, people not only didn't speak English, of course, why would you expect that? But they didn't speak Italian, because my friend spoke Italian and French and German and English. So, my point, I mean, it was different and it wasn't better for sure. But my point is that what was that line? That line was just a policy line. It was just a policy line. And the immigration makes it very clear that that's part, but also probably the quality of the beer. You know what I mean? Like, everything is divided by the policy line.
And if your first act of going into the country is an illegal thing, then it kind of sets you up.
That I don't agree with. Because I believe in the right to work and travel. And if
I don't agree. You think sneaking in, though, is you don't think that's circumnavigating?
You know, I if somebody want, if I fly somebody directly to Burbank Airport, pick them up and have them live in my house and mm-hmm. never, I actually paid for the road outside my house.
Right.
Like I have paid a lot of taxes. I have some right to ingress and egress. I am not permitted to have a private road at a certain point. You have to allow the postman to access your house. That's another mm-hmm. thing. Like you do not have private property. They insist on the porosity. Therefore they insist on owning those roads. But if I want somebody to live in my house, my cousin from Ireland and take care of my kids, like I don't think you should be able to stop me from doing that. So I don't think it's wrong. I think the problem is that we've decided that we're going to share this meta border. And then you get to decide who you, we have to agree on who gets to come in and who gets to come out.
Yeah. And there is a difference though, because if you are selective of who you bring into the country for a specific reason, you've done some vetting on your own. And there is a track record of where that person is through air tickets and even, but when you have holes in a wall and they're bringing in Chinese or people, any, you know, anybody that is not got good, you can't vet who's here. You're just setting yourself up for the Trojan horse because there is no process.
Yeah. But the problem is that what they are coming here for are to exploit
right.
problems that have emerged because of bad policies, such as drug laws, minimum yes. wage, welfare. These are yes. bad laws that they police us from exploiting. And that's why there are these huge gaps. I remember when the Russians started coming into New York and taking over the nursing homes and just laughing. It's like, this is free money from the government. Nobody's watching. We don't even have to take care of these people.
No, we're on the same page.
Yeah. Yes. Culturally, you know, the Americans just don't have that mindset and it was exploitable. And that's the thing is that all these bad laws create these opportunities for people to come in and take. Yes. Yeah, so that's why you have yep. to control the border. But I'd rather restore private property. I would rather eliminate welfare. I'd rather eliminate the minimum wage. I'd rather eliminate the drug laws.
You don't
I'd rather
get do gift all those cards things. When you come in. You don't get cell phones. There's no all that.
The UBI yes. and stuff. It's insane. Yeah. That's yeah. what attracts people, even You're if they don't right. want to be here. And you 100 know years ago when my grandparents came, if you weren't sick, you were allowed in.
That's right. Well, and you assimilated. And some of them went back. That's right. And you assimilated into the culture. You kind of agreed we'll keep some stuff, but we're going to find some common ground because we're going to share the turf as much as possible. I think we've created a mousetrap without the trap. We've just put a yeah. bunch of cheese out and we've not had any way to stop that.
And the thing is, I feel like the American culture, I've been thinking about this, the American culture is a producer and consumer culture. It's not like religion-based. It's not ethnic-based. It's production and consumption. So 100 years ago, before there was welfare and everything, if you were leaving your ethnic religious culture because you didn't like it and you were coming to this one because you thought that's what you wanted to eat what you killed, and it worked for you, you stayed, you had to learn the language, you had to, you know, have the right hygiene and presentation. Yeah. And speak if you language, didn't,
yeah.
yeah, my Syrian great-grandfather, he went back. It didn't work for him. You were, because of the nature of the culture, as a consumerist culture, just having the sink or swim nature of mm-hmm. the atmosphere, it meant that you were there for that culture and you were surviving in that culture, on that culture's terms, or you were going back. Here, you're attracting people who aren't here for that reason. There's just a lot of loopholes. There's just a lot of things that are attracting them.
You said something that is very important. And when your family came here, the ones that decided to stay, not only was it, do I have what it takes to assimilate and change enough, but also there was an element of responsibility to your neighbors and to the people around you. It's like, we are building this together. And you may speak a different language. You may have a different religion. We may have disagreements, but I'm going to help you raise your barn. You're going to help me feed my cows. When you get sick, we'll come take care of your kids. There was this, the community that forced you to kind of let go of some of your differences and your prejudices. It doesn't mean you always liked everybody, but if we're going to make it in this little village we've built, then by God, we all have to take our turn in the fields.
You know, a lot of those villages were ethnic, religious, national, cultural. They were. So you had the Polish neighborhood, you had the Irish neighborhood, you had people who were like-minded, whose language you understood. And I mean that both literally language, but also style. Like, you know what something mm-hmm. means. You know what somebody means when they say it this way as opposed to that yeah. way. And that was the community. And that so they could maintain that. So it was side by side cultures. There, it's not multicultural. It's side by side cultures, and then you do get assimilated. Then kids will, you know, forge out to a different neighborhood, a different industry.
An Irish girl marries an Italian boy.
There was tons of that, and you made the decision that you were going to expose future generations to that kind of integration. But it was a pretty natural thing, and I think it emerged from having more liberty, not less. So to come out and say, like, I wish they would close the borders. What I really wish is that they would take away all the problems that they've created with bad, unconstitutional laws.
I understand what you're saying. And now I agree with what you're saying. Yeah. And I think you could probably do both, but right now I just want to put a fire out. I feel like we've got this huge fire.
No, I understand completely. Yeah, I'm living in a fantasy world. No, I understand. Libertarian thing is great. And as I always say, like, libertarians die by the sword, but they don't live by it. We have to deal with what we have right now. We are paying for them. We are paying for it. And it's breaking us individually. Like, my tax rate is, now that I live in California, like, they're basically taking more than we get to keep. We've got five people to support, you know, like, it's just it's crazy. And then they give the money away. Like, New York City is, I'm sure California is as bad as New York, but New York was in the news recently for, you know, giving them the credit cards and stuff. I mean, it's just, it's a moral hazard. You're attracting people, you're paying them to come. They need to want to come for other reasons.
I want to say one more thing and we'll move on to the last topic. You've been really good with your time, by the way. And this right here, what you're doing is what people need. They miss it. I'm glad you're back. I'll say this. One of the things that you were saying about these cultural villages that assimilate, like, they come together, assemble. Like, you got your Irish village, you got your Italian, you had these, whatever the villages were, whatever the little towns were. But you know what I think eventually became the American thread is all of them had the commonalities of working hard, learning to get along with each other, the responsibility that comes along with freedom. That was where I think the foundation of America was laid. It's, you and I are different, but we are going to respect the place and take care of the place that gives us the ability to be free. And that means I'm going to defend it even I look different than you, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's I look at my churches anytime I go to a Catholic church, because there have been Catholic missionaries and we now have immigrants from those countries. So there's the Filipinos, the Haitians, there's a lot of Catholic immigrants. So when I'm at my churches, like the church by my mother's house, the church where I am now, it's always a super, super diverse body, mixed marriages, different races, stuff like that. And I mean, I have never experienced any awareness whatsoever or complaints of racism at all. And we're talking about people from different socioeconomic strata, everything, because we're all exactly on the same page with our values and our goals, which means we can and want to work together. And that's what matters. And that's why, you know, we are unique in that we didn't base this country on, some people would argue that we did that
religion. The thing too though is it's somewhere we've lost this ability to say, Monica and I don't have to agree on 10 out of 10 things for us to be friends. We can, you know what I'm saying? It's not like we all have to march to the check every box that, I vote Republican.
Unless they're legislating that stuff.
That's it.
You know, unless they say the Catholic adoption agencies have to give kids to gay couples, you know, if they're legislating that, then I have to convince you to vote against that.
We're almost out of time. Monica Perez, God, I'm glad you're back.
Yes, I am back. I'm back and better than ever.
You have been missed, and I hate that you were gone for that reason, but I'll be honest with you. It seems like you have navigated and it's not over. I know that, but you've done your mother proud by holding the Irish tradition. She would be super proud of you in this moment. So you don't need my affirmation on that. But anyway, thank you for taking the time.
She might be watching the show, Clint. She always loved you. Who's my honey from Tennessee? It's Clint.
No. There's no maybe. She's 100% watching the show.
She's watching the show. She's a big Clint. She's like, shush, Clint is on.
Oh, real quick. Where do people find it and when again? How do they find it?
Okay.
Yeah.
The Monica Perez Show on your favorite podcasting platform. But if you want to hit it live, I don't have a set schedule yet, but when it's on, you can go to my Twitter at Monica Perez Show and see I'll post like we're going live, little pop-up show. But I do them on at 2 o'clock Pacific, 5 o'clock Eastern during the week on YouTube. And then you can watch my show live. You can do the comments. You don't have to listen to the commercials, but if you miss it live, just hit the Monica Perez Show and you can get that commercial free also. Cause there's a premium feed on there for only $5 a month.
Can they go, if they can't remember that, can they go to the monicaperezshow.com?
Yes.
Yeah. Go to the monicaperezshow.com. Follow, subscribe, give her some money, keep her in business, yes, because she's doing good work. Subscribe. Yes. Thank you, Monica Perez.
Thank you, Clinton.